Hi, welcome to the Growth Dummy Summary of The Simple Path to Wealth by J.L. Collins. The Simple Path to Wealth is about how to manage our money so we can enjoy financial freedom and greater wealth. J.L. Collins recommends saving as much as possible, getting out of debt quickly, and investing in low-cost stock index funds. Looking at the online reviews for this book, on Amazon, it has 4.7 stars, and on Goodreads, it has 4.5 stars, which is outstanding. And there were many positive reviews who liked the book's straightforward and specific directions, but there were some critical reviews who did not like it was very focused on Vanguard investment firm and on US-based investments. So let's begin. This is a book on finance and investing, written for people who don't like finance or investing. And that may sound funny, but the simple fact is that most people are not interested in thinking a lot about finance, even though we all understand that it's an important topic. So J.L. Collins wrote The Simple Path to Wealth for those people who just want to know, what do I do? Because at the end of the day, almost nobody cares about becoming a financial expert, but almost everybody wants the end result of financial security and freedom. Well, the good news is that we can keep our investing simple and outperform most professionals, as you'll see in this summary. So you're about to learn important ideas about money that we probably should have learned in school but didn't. Ideas such as how to use stocks to grow our wealth with less risk, and what to do when the markets crash to avoid losing money, and also how bonds can help stabilize our financial journey. Who is the author, J.L. Collins? Well, he's now semi-retired after spending his life working in a tremendous variety of jobs, including some time at an investment research firm. His popular online posts about personal finance were transformed into this book, which has now sold over 400,000 copies. So lesson one is, get FU money. You'll have freedom after saving enough money for several months' worth of expenses. The goal is freedom, flexibility, and options. That means being able to do what we want, when we want, and how we want to. I mean, that's the whole point of getting our finances in order, isn't it? For J.L. Collins, that meant freedom from worrying about his job security and the option to spend more time with family. FU money must be the first goal of our plan for financial freedom. Again, that just means having enough money saved to pay for a few months of expenses. You see, if we're living paycheck to paycheck, as many people do, then we will always feel trapped and scared. On the other hand, having enough money available in our bank account allows us to say, well, F you to any situation that we don't like. And I think the author's colorful language for this makes it easier to remember. So here are a couple tips for getting these emergency savings. First, try saving 50% of your income. That's 50%. That is what J.L. Collins did and what he recommends to others. And that may sound impossible at first, but here's a thought. Aren't many of the necessities in our lives really just nice conveniences that people easily lived without 100 years ago? So maybe we could reconsider what we really need. And a second tip is to see the opportunity cost of each purchase, and this can help us save more. So when we pay $100 for something new, like a new toy or gadget, or spending $100 for a nicer car, we're not just giving up that $100, we're also giving up all the money that $100 could have earned us after being invested. That is called the opportunity cost. It's like a term from economics. And as you'll see in a minute, with the right investment strategy, that money could have grown a surprising amount. Now, there's another great book on personal finance called The Millionaire Next Door, written by two authors who spent 20 years studying millionaires, and what they found was very surprising. You see, most people believe that a typical millionaire lives in a huge mansion, drives a flashy luxury car, and wears expensive designer clothing. But what that book discovered is that the average millionaire is more likely to be a blue-collar small business owner that lives a regular middle-class lifestyle, an average home and average cars. In other words, they are millionaires hidden right next door to you and me. What really makes those people better than the average person at accumulating wealth is not a very high income, but saving at least 15% of their income. In this case, it's 15%. In fact, that book says 2/3 of high-income professionals, like doctors, have relatively low net worth because they fall into a trap of needing to spend more to look successful, like in alignment with their high-status job. So that's just an example of high income not being the most important factor, but saving a higher portion of our income. Can learn more about that in our summary of The Millionaire Next Door on growth.me. But to summarize this lesson, FU money means saving enough cash to pay for several months worth of expenses that can give us freedom from many fears, worries, and anxieties. This author recommends saving 50% of our income, 50%, by considering what we really need and the opportunity costs of each new purchase, what it could have earned after being invested. Now, lesson two is pay debt quickly. Carrying a lot of debt is the biggest obstacle to wealth. Let's say that again. The biggest roadblock to building wealth is debt. Now, in our culture, endless debt has become considered normal. But unless we fight back against those trends, debt will suck up a large part of our income through interest payments and excess consumption. So this author recommends paying off any debt that as soon as possible, especially when it has an interest rate over 5%. Remember, credit cards are usually 20% or higher. We should do that before we even think about investing, because no investment can reliably make us more money than we can save by avoiding those kinds of interest payments. If the interest rate is a little under 5%, then maybe we could pay it off more slowly. How about buying a house and a mortgage? Well, that's often considered a good type of debt, but this author isn't so sure. J.L. Collins suggests that we buy the minimum house that we can live with, because a more expensive house will also cost more in terms of taxes, insurance, maintenance, etc. And then we get back to those opportunity costs of what that money could have earned after being invested. Now, on the other hand, in other places, you do hear financial experts talking positively about houses, saying that a mortgage is like a type of forced savings, because a lot of people forget or neglect to save money for retirement. Then at retirement age, many people's largest asset is their house, which they could sell to have retirement income and then downsize to a smaller living space. So that's a part of their retirement strategies. Now, there's another book called Your Money or Your Life that talks a lot about debt and consumption. It says people often consume material goods because they're trying to use material things to fill needs that are actually psychological and even spiritual. That's why it doesn't work, and why we can never reach the point of having enough stuff or enough money to feel good or fulfilled with it. So in that book, the solution is to get more in touch with our real values, and then we keep track of our monthly spending to make sure that that spending is truly aligned with what is bringing us the maximum satisfaction and fulfillment. Those are some very interesting ideas, very useful for reducing consumption, I think. Can learn about that in our summary of Your Money or Your Life on growth.me. But to summarize lesson two, most debt should be paid off as soon as possible, especially when the interest rate is over 5%. That will pay us off more in the beginning than investing. So to save more money, we should consider whether our consumption really fits our values, such as buying a more modest house. Next is lesson three, buy stock index funds. A better way to grow our wealth is not through buying one stock, but buying all the stocks in the market. Over the long term, the best way to grow our wealth is probably through the stock market. And so this is a key part of J.L. Collins' strategy in The Simple Path to Wealth. Because when we look at the stock market as a whole, it's grown by about 11.9% per year on average since the 1950s, and probably even since the 1970s, depending on what measure you use, and that number includes investing dividends, but we don't need to worry about that right now. But what that really means is $10,000 invested in 1980 in the stock market would be worth almost $1 million by 2020. So it's a surprisingly high amount when it increases by 11.9% per year, and that compounds year after year after year. So there are three main ways to invest in stocks. First, we could pick individual stocks. So anybody can buy shares in a public company like Google or Tesla, and then we basically own a small part of that company. Now, that is risky because it's very hard to predict the future, and even companies that look unstoppable today could fail in the future, just like, you know, GM and Kodak used to be gigantic companies. But nobody really knows which companies will succeed or fail. There are a few investors like Warren Buffett that are successful by picking stocks over the long term, but this author says we must have humility that we are simply never going to have their level of talent and skill. It's kind of like no matter how much we practice basketball, we're never going to be the next Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant. Okay, so a second way to invest in stocks is through actively managed mutual funds. And that means an expert picks a collection of stocks for us in hopes that it will give us better returns than the market as a whole. And that sounds great in theory, but some studies have found that these actively managed funds don't perform better than the market as a whole. They usually underperform. For example, a study by Vanguard of 1,540 actively managed mutual funds over 15 years found that 82% of them underperform the overall market and/or they get shut down because they don't perform. And so our odds of picking a winning fund that beats the market are just 18%, which is not great. And we need to remember these funds are often marketed by saying they have had great returns over the past 2 or 3 years, but that can easily be luck. So the third way to invest in stocks, and the way this book recommends, is through index funds. That means we invest a little bit into all the stocks in the market, every single one. And that allows our money to grow at the same rate as the stock market as a whole. So, if we invest in the top 500 stocks in the market, we own a little bit of all 500 companies. And there are some funds which invest in thousands of stocks. So, as we've seen, over decades, the return for the stock market as a whole has been 11.9% with dividends reinvested. And at that rate of growth will almost certainly beat picking individual stocks or an actively managed mutual fund. Now, there's a very, very important disclaimer from the author in this book saying that we are not guaranteed to make 11% on average in the future, simply because nobody can predict the future. So even though this kind of growth has happened in the past, that doesn't mean it will definitely continue in the future. So this number of 11.9% is simply used in the book to quote-unquote explore the possibilities and the power of investing in stocks. And also that 11.9% number does not include taxes or inflation. So perhaps a more realistic number, maybe 8%. That's what I've seen mentioned in other personal finance books. So in the past, if we had invested in stocks, our money could have grown by 8% or somewhat more, but it's no guarantee for sure that it will happen in the future. So there's always some risk here. So when it comes to stock index funds, J.L. Collins specifically recommends the investment firm Vanguard, and especially their index fund that is named VTSAX. So this is a specific fund that you can buy with your investment firm. And this is where he keeps most of his wealth, like 70 to 90% of it. It's called VTSAX, a stock index fund. So why did he choose this company, Vanguard? Well, they were the original pioneers of this idea, index funds, and their fees continue to be very low, often the lowest. The company was started by a man named John Bogle in 1976, and Vanguard's business structure was absolutely unique. You see, usually investment firms are run by owners who make profits by selling their funds to customers like us. But with Vanguard, the people who buy the funds are also the owners of the company. You become an owner when you buy the fund. And the practical result of that is that their funds have some of the lowest fees because they are operated almost at costs, because that's what makes the most sense when the interests are aligned between the customers and the owners. So let's talk about index funds in general. They have much lower fees than actively managed mutual funds because they're mostly automated. It's just buying, you know, all the top 500 or all the 8,000 stocks in the market. So you don't need to pay a lot of high-priced executives and financial managers. For example, the average actively managed mutual fund charges 1.25% in fees, and that's called an expense ratio, while Vanguard's VTSAX costs only 0.05%. Now, that's a 1.2% difference. It may not sound like a lot, but over a lifetime of saving and investing, that turns out to be a large portion of each year's growth, of what wealth we could have earned from our investments. And remember, it repeats year after year after year that we're paying this 1%. Now, we should beware that some financial advisors have been more likely to promote those actively managed mutual funds in the past because higher fees allow for higher sales commissions. So clearly, there may be a conflict of interest, and that is why one whole chapter in this book is titled Why I Don't Like Investment Advisors. So if you read the top-rated modern personal finance books that have come out in the past few years, then you'll see this topic of index funds showing up very frequently in almost every single book. It seems everybody is recommending index funds, from the great book called Millionaire Teacher by Andrew Hallam, to Tony Robbins' book, Unshakable. Even Warren Buffett has written that after his death, the wealth that his life is left with will be invested into a low-cost index fund. So even Warren Buffett doesn't trust other people to pick stocks better than the market as a whole. So as a result of all those financial educators, index funds have been shooting up in popularity over the past 10 years, so they now actually make up the top 5 mutual funds in the world. And so to summarize lesson 3, over the past 70 years and more, the stock market has risen by 11.9% per year on average. Picking individual stocks can be very risky, and actively managed mutual funds appear to underperform the market 82% of the time. Therefore, J.L. Collins recommends index stock funds like Vanguard's VTSAX, which are composed of every stock in the market. Lesson 4 is build mental toughness. We avoid losing money with a long-term perspective of the economy. So the stock market is very volatile, which means it goes up and down dramatically. It's like riding a roller coaster. And while it's true that on average, the US stock market does go up over time, along the way, there have been many large downturns every 10 years or so. The most recent ones being the 2008 financial crisis, the dot-com bubble crash, a recession in the early 90s, and another one in the early 80s, and another one in the mid-70s, and so on. I think you get the point. And that's not even mentioning the fact that as I'm recording this, going into 2023, there's probably another recession coming up. But when the stock market crashed in the past, all those times, the worst thing we could have done is to panic and sell our investments, because then we would have been locking in our losses. If we had just held on for maybe 2 or 3 years each time until the recovery, then we would have actually lost nothing. So this is a much better way to think about recessions, which is that in the past, the market has always recovered, so we need to not sell at the bottom. That's the most important thing. And here are some more tips for building this mental toughness. First, learn the history. So if we understand that recessions are normal, they're to be expected every 10 years or so, then we can avoid getting too emotional. Often we look at the news and, you know, they make money through getting more advertising and more page views. And so they tend to feed those emotions of panic and excitement because that gets more attention. Another tip is to just keep buying. If we look in the past, during all those downturns and recessions, the best move that we could have made would have been to continue buying stock index funds. You see, one interesting way to look at it is that during a downturn, stocks have actually gone on sale for a short time. The price is lower. And so it can actually be the best time, for example, for young people to begin their investment journey. During a recession, they're buying stocks at a much lower price, and then the price will recover and they'll grow wealth faster. And when we look at big investors like Warren Buffett, this is what they do. During downturns and recessions, they buy more. I think Warren Buffett has a famous quote to be fearful when others are greedy and to be greedy when others are fearful. So a good thing to keep in mind. A final tip is don't try to time the market. You see, many people have this idea that they'll wait until the market stops going down before they buy. But the simple fact is that it's almost impossible for us to predict the right timing of when the stock market will turn around. Just as it's surprisingly difficult to pick winning stocks, it's also surprisingly difficult to get the timing right. And so what usually happens is that people wait too long and the stocks have already gone up and then they're buying at a premium. So it's better that we simply buy all the time and not try to wait for the best time. Now, one of the most popular self-help books about getting wealthy is called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. It tells a story of a man named R.U. Darby who went on a quest to find gold. So he traveled west in America, and he bought all this expensive equipment, and he began digging for gold in a spot where some gold had been found. But after a few months, without finding any gold, he gave up. And so he sold all the equipment to a local man, and he moved back home. Now that man who bought the equipment, he went back to the same spot and continued digging, and just 3 feet deeper, he found a huge tons of gold. So the moral of that story is encapsulated by this quote from the book. One of the most common causes of failure is the habit of quitting when one is overtaken by temporary defeat, end quote. And I guess that quote is often used to motivate people to continue with a business idea or startup, not to quit before it's had a chance to gain traction. But in the same way, selling our investments during a market downturn, will mean that we lose all that money and we miss out on all the growth in wealth when the market eventually turns around. It's like we've stopped 3 feet from the gold when we were digging. So to learn more about that in our summary of Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. But to summarize lesson 4, while the stock market does go up on average, it is also true that every 10 years or so, there's a serious downturn, crash, or recession. The most important thing to do during those times is to remain calm and to not sell our investments, or else we will lock in our losses. And next we have lesson 5, stabilize with bonds. As we get older, we can reduce downswings in our wealth through bond index funds. So even if you know nothing about investment, I'm sure you've heard people talking about stocks and bonds. These two go together like ketchup and mustard or salt and pepper. What I'm saying is that bonds are the second major type of investment in the simple path to wealth. But what is a bond? Well, when we buy a bond, what we're actually doing is loaning our money to a government or a large company for a specific number of years. In return, they promise to pay us some interest each year, and at the end, they'll pay us back all the money. So the main benefit of bonds is to stabilize our journey of growing wealthier, as bonds are far less volatile than stocks, which means they don't go up or down so much. And avoiding those large downswings in our wealth becomes more important as we near retirement age, because we don't have as much time to recover from those market downturns. And that's why older people are pretty much always recommended to hold more bonds in their investments portfolio, while younger people should be holding more stocks to benefit from their superior growth potential over the long term. So the basic formula for how much money we should be holding in stocks versus bonds is this. 100 minus our age goes to stocks. So for example, let's say someone is 40 years old. 100 minus 40 is 60. So that person could hold 60% of their wealth in stocks and 40% in bonds. But some people have different attitudes toward this. So like this author, J.L. Collins, is more aggressive with his investments. He's more oriented towards growth, and he doesn't care so much about those downswings over 3 or 5 years. And so he is invested in 75% stocks and 20% bonds and 5% cash in a bank account. That's like the emergency fund. So he has more stocks than is sometimes recommended to a person his age, because he just wants to be more aggressive in potential growth. So when it comes to bonds, this book recommends again that we don't choose specific individual bonds, but that we buy something called a bond index fund, and especially one from Vanguard named VBTLX. So again, we can go to financial firm or advisor or our online service, and we can look up VBTLX, at least if we're in the US. If we're in other countries, we'll need to find a different bond index fund most likely. But that bond index fund from Vanguard, it contains a wide variety of bonds, almost 8,000 bonds in the US, which allows someone to avoid the risk of buying a bond from a single government or company that later may not be able to pay them back, which does happen. Governments and companies do go bankrupt sometimes. Now let's talk more about that idea of avoiding risk through diversification. Diversification just means spreading our money out. So there's a core reason why index funds are so good. We're spreading our money out through a lot of different companies and bonds. Now, one of the biggest criticisms that you'll hear about J.L. Collins' strategy, like on his blog, the comments, or if you look on Amazon, the reviews for this book, the big criticism is that it's too US-centric, because he basically recommends 2 US-based index funds, one for stocks and one for bonds. So maybe it's a little bit too simple. Like, what if the US stock market stops growing for 10 or 20 years? That may seem improbable because it hasn't happened over the past 70 years or more, but it did happen in other places like Japan. In the 1980s, the Japanese stock market was growing at an incredible rate. But then, it was followed by decades of essentially stagnation beginning in 1990. Well, the answer to that question or concern that's given in this book is essentially that every investment type has risks, but no other investment is likely to grow as much as the US stock index. And also, if we keep our wealth in cash, it will definitely be shrinking every year due to inflation. No matter which type of investment we pick, it's going to have some kind of risks of not growing. But other people say that we can reduce that risk by adding at least an international stock index fund and an international bond index fund to our investment portfolios. Many other personal finance authors recommend that strategy for greater diversification, so that even if the US stock market stagnates, perhaps other stock markets in Europe or in Asia or elsewhere will be growing. J.L. Collins doesn't do that strategy because he argues the largest US companies are already highly international companies. They sell products and services all around the world, and therefore they're already not reliant on the US economy. So he believes that buying stocks in the biggest US companies already makes his money diversified to the international economy. So that's definitely an argument worth thinking about. Now here's another way that we could invest, which may be the simplest way of all. It's called target retirement funds. And these are offered by Vanguard and other investment firms. Basically, with these kinds of funds, we just pick our target year of retirement, and then the investment firm automatically puts it into domestic and international stock and bond index funds. However, the fees are slightly higher than buying individual index funds, although it does have the benefit of being very simple and automated, so it's definitely worth looking into if we want the absolute simplest approach. Those are called target retirement funds at Vanguard. We just need to make sure that they do rely on those stock index funds that we talked about before and not actively managed funds. Now, there's another book called Rich Dad Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki, and this may be the most popular book ever written on money and in terms of self-help. It's about the story of Kiyosaki learning the habits of the rich from his friend's father, who was a very successful entrepreneur in Hawaii. And the most important lesson he learned was this, that poor and middle-class people work for income, while rich people buy assets that make them money. What kind of assets? Well, we talked about two of them already, stocks and bonds, but other good assets mentioned in that book include real estate that generates income, so not a personal home because that usually doesn't generate income. Another asset is businesses that don't need our physical presence all the time. Another asset is intellectual property that gives royalties, like music, books, patents, etc. So all these assets are things that generate money to us to grow our wealth. And also, you can check out our summary of Rich Dad Poor Dad on growth.me. To summarize lesson 5, a bond is a loan with a specific end date that we provide to a government or a large company in exchange for annual interest payments. To reduce risk, this book recommends bond index funds, especially VBTLX by Vanguard. There are also target retirement funds, which offer more diversification by including international funds, and they're also more simple. Okay, our final lesson is to, number 6, withdraw 4% per year. To avoid running out of money during retirement, don't withdraw too much. So here's a great question. how much do we need to save for retirement? Well, we can actually work backwards to find the answer. The big number to remember is 4%. That is how much we can withdraw per year from our investments during retirement. And if we do that, there's a 96% chance that we won't run out of money. But if we withdraw more than 4%, then the chance that we run out of money increases. That magic number was discovered in 1998 by three professors in Trinity University, and ever since then, it's been a staple of personal finance advice, and this book recommends it too. Now, their example portfolio included 50% stocks and 50% bonds, while J.L. Collins would lean more in the direction of stocks. So, here are a couple example scenarios how we can calculate how much money we need for retirement. So if we want to have a retirement income of $40,000 per year, then we know that $40,000 is 4% of $1 million, so that's how much we need to save $1 million by the time we retire. Then we can withdraw 4% of that, which is going to be $40,000. So I hope you see how this works. On the other hand, what if we could live with $20,000 per year in retirement? Well, then we only need $500,000. So it all depends on how much we want and need. If we can live with less in retirement, then perhaps we could retire earlier because we don't need as much money saved. Now, another way to increase our financial stability in retirement is remaining aware and flexible about the economy. This author says that he actually goes a bit higher or lower in his withdrawals than that 4% number based on how the stock market is doing. So if the value of stocks is going down, if there's a downturn, then he's prepared to be more frugal with his spending to go below 4% in withdrawals, and that helps him preserve his wealth and decrease the odds of running out of money. See, I guess when the value of stocks is going down, if we're still withdrawing the same amount, then we're going to end up with less in 10 or 20 years. On the other hand, if the value of stocks is going up and they're very high, then maybe we could even withdraw more. So to summarize lesson 6, during retirement, we can withdraw about 4% of our investments per year to avoid running out of money 96% of the time. For example, if we want $40,000 annual income in retirement, we would need to save $1 million over our career. Okay, let's finish up with three practical action steps for how we could apply this book to our lives. Action step number one is to write down three expenses you could reduce or eliminate by next month. I think the easiest way to do this would be looking at our credit card or bank statements. Often we forget how much money we're spending in certain areas, or we have some expense that we forgot about, like a subscription that we no longer use. So this exercise is the first step to freeing up our income, more of our income, so we can use that money to get quicker out of debt or to build that emergency fund or to increase investing. It's important to begin saving more of our money. Action step number two is to calculate the opportunity cost of a large purchase. And that means seeing not just how much something is costing us, but also what it could cost in terms of potential future growth. For example, $100, if we put it into a stock index fund that returns 8% per year on average, that could be worth over $735 in 25 years. So that's a very impressive future payoff, and it can make us think twice about what we are spending money on today. And you can find calculators online that can help you with calculating these opportunity costs over 10, 20, 30 years. Action step number three is to open an investment account and invest $50. See, sometimes the first step can be the most important to take. So if you don't have a place yet to invest your savings, it may be surprising how easy it is to begin. Sometimes we get intimidated, but we could actually just go to our bank and to speak with someone and have an account open in 30 minutes. We could go to a bank or go to an investment firm like Vanguard, which this book recommends, although you may need to be in the US to use Vanguard. There are also online services that are becoming increasingly popular, like Wealthfront in the US or WealthSimple in Canada, which I use personally. So these are often called robo-advisors, and they generally do rely on index funds in their portfolios. Okay, so I hope you found this book summary useful, and I'll see you in the next one.